Hello, I'm Rosie Swash and welcome to Music Weekly Extra featuring an extended interview with Erasure's Andy Bell. Bell, alongside synth-pop maestro Vince Clark, formed Erasure in 1985. Over the next decade, this multi-million selling pair would make some of the finest, most memorable electronic music of their time, including songs A Little Respect and Sometimes. Both myself and Tim Jones are huge fans, so we broke with tradition and teamed up to speak to the voice behind some of our favourite hits. I wanted to get a sort of impression from you of what it was like in Peterborough, which is where you're from. You were born in the mid-60s, so you were growing up there in the 60s and 70s, and just what your life was like then, pre-Erasure.
Right, well, it's kind of... I did want to be in a band when I was in Peterborough, but... and we did discuss it in my school that we were in with some other guys, but we never ever had a rehearsal or didn't do anything, you know. But I had a real interest in music. My music was really just from listening to the charts and taping the charts and things, and listening to Radio Caroline in my bed at night time. Apart from that, there wasn't really much going on. I mean, there was a few punk bands and things that I used to go and see, and I used to hang out at the so-called druggy pubs, you know, where they had spliffs and things, and the Still, which was like a microbrewery in the town centre. But I used to kind of pretend that I was a rebel, but I wasn't really, you know, and kind
did
of
punk not really do it for you.
No, it was too punk was too hard. Mm-hmm. I thought the people were kind of not very nice, you know, and I kind of tried to stick a pin through my side of my mouth, but it didn't really work. So I was more into Susie and the Banshees, soft punk, you know, and Blondie. I mean, they weren't considered punk. And Lena Lovitch and Nina Hagen. And then I remember reading a thing in the Daily Mirror saying, oh, to see whether your son's on drugs or not. And it has all these things like the room will smell of strawberries and like these ridiculous things. So I brought some strawberry incense and took the curtains down from my bedroom window and like would dress my window each day and things, and like had my record player inside my wardrobe because it made the speakers sound better inside. It boomed more, so I was a bit sort of like, my granddad used to call me rum. He said I was a rum bugger, he said, and that was before he knew anything.
Did you always know you could sing? You said you had, you know, aspirations.
I kind of knew I could sing. I mean, I was going to be in the cathedral choir when I went to grammar school, and we didn't get round to filling out the forms and things like that, you know. But I was in school choirs and things like that. And I did sing to the babysitters and things so I could stay up a bit later.
And what was the... So, you know, famously you saw the Vince Clark's advert in Melody Maker.
Yeah, I'd been in London a few years then, and I had been in a band called The Void. And that was just kind of a back garden rehearsing in the garage kind of thing with guitars and drums, and then I persuaded the bass player to leave the band and form a duo with me so we could like do electro music, and we kind of copied things like Eurythmics and things like that, and then we'd been together for about a year. We did two gigs. One was in a Southall Domino's club, which was like a West Indian club, and the other one was in Ealing Park, which we got pelted by eggs by some builders. And so I thought, well, this is not going very far. And we did try to get a record deal going around everywhere, but nobody was really interested. And I was working with a guy called Pete Gage, who was in a band called Vinegar Joe. He kind of produced us. So I thought, well, I was in there, you know, but nothing happened. So I looked in the music papers and saw the Vince advert. It didn't say it was him. And they also, it was filled up on that weekend for the auditions, and they said they'd call me back, which I didn't think they would, but then they did, and I was over the moon.
You were the 36th person.
43rd.
43rd, yeah. Was it?
Yeah.
43rd.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously he was after a specific kind of, you know, he wasn't just going to...
Yeah, I think Vince was quite frustrated because he said that they were mostly cabaret-ish type singers that came along and older, and I thought my voice was fantastic when I was younger. You know, I mean, I thought my voice was as good as Elvis, and I thought I was going to, like, change the world and sell millions and millions of records and stuff like that. Now I kind of realise, you know...
But you have sold millions and millions
a few, but now, you know, you kind of have to put it all in perspective, and I think, well, actually, it's not that strong, your voice, you know, and you can... I mean, I can do live gigs and things like that in June and dance and things like that, but you do get very carried away when you're younger.
So what did you think when you turned up and you saw Vince Clarke there? Did that put a lot of pressure on, or did you even know who he was? Or
yeah, I mean, I was a huge Vince Clarke fan. Okay. And I had seen him once. I'd been for an audition for a Bow Wow Wow spin-off band, and Vince was there in Blackwing Studios, which he used to half own, I think. And I saw him, and he was like one of the first famous people that I saw, and I was like, wow, that's Vince Clarke, you know, on the Space Invaders machine. And then so he'd kind of been in my mind's eye. And then after Yazoo split, which I was a huge fan of, I said, oh, maybe I should write Vince a letter and see if he needs a new singer. But I didn't know where to write to or anything. So when this advert came up and it happened to be him, I just thought, well, this is it. This is meant to be. But I was very, very nervous of him. And they were quite laddish in the studio, even though they're trying to make me feel comfortable. And they said they kind of had an inkling that I might have been gay, because all these young boys kept coming round to the studio to visit me. You know?
At that point, did he have an idea of what he wanted from Erasure, or was it just, I want to start a new project?
Well, he was trying The Assembly, and this was a project which was going to be him writing with all these different singers doing the songs, a bit like Soul to Soul did later on. But at the time, it didn't work out. So Flood, who we did the first album with, said to Vince, you better get a full-time singer again. And I think he was just looking for someone that was kind of quite inexperienced and sort of had a unique voice, really, you know. But I did used to rehearse all the time to Alison Moyet records. So I think that's why I picked up her intonation, and people said that, oh, did he choose you because you sounded like her? But it wasn't the case.
Wasn't conscious.
No.
You said Vince might have had an inkling you were gay, but Erasure became such a, you know, big band for the gay community.
Yeah.
I just wondered, you know, what that felt like at the time, because it must have been quite exciting when it was
really exciting. I don't think there's ever been as an exciting period in my life. You know, we were going to Gay Pride, it was free then, and it was on the South Bank, you know, and Erasure had just started, and Jimmy Somerville was around with the Communards, you know, we'd had the Bronxky Beat, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and so it was this whole gay political movement, you know, and we were going on marches all the time. We had this this pub called The Bell, where everything was organised from in King's Cross, and we're doing collections for Solidarity from Poland, in Poland, and all sorts of things going on, you know, and the anti-clause 28 march, you know, and some homophobic policemen in Rugby were marching against them, and all kinds of things. So we really got carried away with the whole wave going on, you know, and it was really exciting.
What do you think the essence of an Erasure song is?
To me, I think we're a bit sort of bombastic, or we're a bit over the top. So to me, it's kind of like Wizard, band Wizard, with kind of soul and then minimal synth. So I think it's quite hard for a lot of people to kind of get to grips with, you know, and it's not as easy as some other bands, I don't think, to listen to.
My girlfriend's got a live DVD, actually, of you dressed in a giant purple, kind of like Dairy Milk wrapper, so I don't know what makes you think it's quite over the top. Do you have any kind of favourite costumes from the past?
I do, yeah. I mean, some of them I don't know where they are, they've disappeared. But one of them was, I took an exact copy, my friend Dean Bright made it, from Marilyn Monroe from the film Bus Stop. And it's kind of like this really lovely showgirl outfit, much like Kylie wears now. And we wore that for America, and that was in with the ruby slippers. But my favourite out of all of them was just a pair of Calvin Kleins, a white corset, and 6-inch Vivienne Westwood red PVC high heels.
Do you think that's missing from the kind of current pop scene a bit? A bit of kind of...
Well, everything seems to be now... It's a bit kind of porno-ish, I think, now, everything. Don't mean to get political or anything, but I hate the sexualisation of children. I really do. And all these bands wearing virtually nothing, all these girl bands, it's not very healthy, I don't think.
I had an interview with John Savage a while ago, because he brought out a new wave electro compilation, which is really brilliant. Yazoo were on there. Because obviously he's known as a punk journalists, you know, mainly. And I said to him, you know, what is it about this period of music in Britain as much as anywhere else that really made it so wonderful? And he said, because it was such a reaction as to what came before.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean, you talked a little bit about that before in terms of the political, you know, the gay rights movement and stuff like that. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, for me, it was kind of like, not that it was a backlash against punk, but it was kind of the same thing because, as Vince said, you know, he couldn't play guitar, so he bought a synthesizer and found out that you could make really amazing music with it and in your bedroom, you know. I remember and when I first heard The Human League, I mean, I didn't hear their previous albums, but when I first heard Dare, I thought it was fantastic, you know, and Soft Cell, and so raw as well in some ways. And also the electronic music has always remained underground. For some reason, pop bands use it, and they use synthesizers and things to kind of embellish their songs, you know, make them commercial. But the hardcore electro has always been underground, and I really love that. I love going to clubs and hearing the electronic music on big amps in the clubs and things. It goes right through your bones. It's the same for me when I'm on stage performing live with Vince's music. It literally rattles your bones and goes inside your body, and I think it couldn't do that because that's kind of some reflection of the music itself and what it stands for.
So which Erasure songs do you think are the perfect for kind of blasting out on a big
For blasting out, I would say the songs that work like that live, I think it's going to be something like Chorus and You Surround Me, and there's something with like with a huge bass on them. I get a bit sort of fed up with the up-tempo, Love to Hate You type songs.
Oh, really?
You know, they're lovely, but you know, I prefer more like Breath of Life because it's kind of more melancholic and softer in some way.
I think that about all of your songs. I think there's a melancholy edge to all of them, which is why I think
there's always a yearning. I've got a yearning. I don't know if you can be a singer if you haven't got one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a cry.
And what's the song that everybody wants to hear when you play?
People always want to hear Little Respect or Sometimes.
And do you always play it for
them? You have to play those songs. Yeah. I remember, you know, it's quite, I mean, when we bought out the Erasure album in 1995, and it was kind of our first flop, really, and we came onto the stage and with Fingers and Thumbs, which is the first single from Erasure, and I thought it was going to be, wow, the audience is going to love it, and it's going to be, and no, there was just no reaction whatsoever, because they hadn't heard it on the radio, so I thought, oh, okay.
You do get a very, very strong live following, because I remember seeing you in Hammersmith Apollo. It's one of those crowds I was really taken aback.
Yeah.
A lot of interaction there.
It is, and it's kind of like, you do have to be careful, I think. You know, you have to be careful of what you say as well when you're there, because it's, I think they could go for you. You know, if it's, I'm not saying they're aggressive, but they really, really
want to hear
you
those
belong
hits
to them, you know. That's it.
You were talking before about being a bit depressed by the state of, you know, modern pop, but there's two sort of strands going on. One is, which, you know, Pop 40 is out, Depeche Mode are coming back with something, Pet Shop Boys are back, and then you've got all these young women, mainly, like, you know, Lady Hawk, Little Boots, who play, you know, obviously influenced by that kind of music.
It's not just the kind of musicians who are kind of coming back, because I've noticed when I DJ out, if I ever put a Little Respect on or stop, it is without doubt the most popular record of the night. So it's kind of almost like, you know, you've gone from being a massive selling band in the 80s and the early 90s to kind of fading away a bit to now becoming a real hipster reference point.
Yeah.
Is that quite satisfying?
It is, yeah. I really like that. You know, I really like the fact that we've got our hardcore audience. You know, when we were really, really popular, you kid yourself that all those people really, really like you because they bought those records and they're going to be with you forever, but they're not. They kind of like buy what's ever in the charts and things, or if you're on the TV all the time, which we're not now. That sort of like dies down, and it's almost like you have to wait for a new generation to come along and that haven't heard it through their mum or their dad and discover it for themselves, you know, and like take it on face value, which is really cool.
What do you think that you would be doing now if you hadn't have got that audition with Vince Clarke?
If I hadn't got the audition, I think I would have carried on. I probably would have been in another band, or I might have joined a choir, or I might have gone into theatre or into light opera or something like that. Vince is a great bloke. He's a really brilliant person, and I think he's really kept my feet on the floor, on the ground, because I can be misled quite easily, you know. So he's been very good.